Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, we're all regulars tonight, and some irregulars. This is a distinctive week in our world history, with the entire world looking closely at climate change and solutions, or ways to live with this climate. And last week I was in Racine, Wisconsin, at a Branching Streams conference. Branching Streams is the group of 75 Zen centers throughout the United States and Canada and parts of Europe and Mexico, even South America. Those 75 that have all kind of sprung out of the San Francisco Zen Center, teachers that have moved away out of San Francisco and started Zen centers throughout the world, the Western world anyway. And they get together for a 4-day conference every 2 years, and this year it was sponsored by the Milwaukee Zen Center and held it at a retreat center in Racine, which is just about 30 miles away. And there were about 50 of us there, representing a little over 20 of the 75 possibilities. And I've gone a few times, and Edie's gone, and I think Jean, did you go when it was in San Francisco about 10 years ago? And have you been to any of them? So they spread them around. In 2 years, it's going to be on the West Coast again. But befitting this time of looking at the climate, that was the theme of the conference, how Zen and Zen centers might look at climate change. The speaker for almost a full day was Stephanie Kaza, who is a just retired professor of environmental. I've lost it. What do you major in?
Studies.
Environmental studies. Thank you. In Vermont, but in the 80s. She got her PhD in environmental studies right here in Santa Cruz through the history of consciousness. And while she was doing that, she lived in that house right next door where Kokyo lives, and was a student of Coben. She's written several books on Buddhism and its interface with the environment. She, along with Joanna Macy and David Loy and Bhikkhu Bodhi in the Theravada tradition, are kind of prominent Buddhist climate thinkers and activists that have all written many books on the topic over the last couple of decades. We, of course, were lucky enough to have a workshop here with Joanna Macy. Stephanie Kaza is now back in her hometown of Portland. And we talked about her coming here. We shared a bus ride together to the airport and talked about the old Coben days. And she's been keeping up with us, and she's been keeping up with Jikoji. And she said she'd love to come down, and that would be great. But she said that Buddhist practice is just what is a practice to have when looking at climate change. Our practice of non-harm, or a disciple of Buddha does not kill, along with the rest of the precepts, are all about non-harming. So it, you know, practicing the precepts and non-harm, we might look at toxins in the environment. We might look at how much of our natural resources we use for energy, in energy extraction. She along with Joanna Macy, also used the concept of deep time to look at climate change and climate and outcomes. You know, our concept of the kalpas, these kind of periods of endless time that our consciousness abides in. She says, you know, we say we've only got 10 years to really turn the clock back, but in terms of the climate, but you know, we might not make it. And then, you know, we have to look at, you know, how our consciousness will abide in deep time, even past the 10 years, even past the possible extinction of life. So that idea of deep time, the Buddhist idea of kalpas, is something that helps us look at this. It changes our perspective on climate change. And then what she spent a lot of time with, and what I'm going to say a little bit more on, is the central Buddhist idea of dependent co-arising. The simplest form of that. This being that exists. Through the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not exist. Through the ceasing of this, that ceases. That's Buddha's simplest explanation of dependent co-arising, kind of the pool cue, the simplest model of one thing causing another thing to happen. And if that first thing doesn't happen, that second thing won't arise. And if that first thing ceases, that second thing won't arise. Dependent call rising is just very central to our Buddhist practice. And in the Theravada school, it said that the understanding of dependent co-arising is equivalent to understanding the entire Dharma, the entire Pali Canon. So it really is central in our teaching. Dependent co-arising, or pratitya samuppada. Dependent co-arising. And Jean's talked about another model, the 12-fold chain of dependent arising. And we all pretty much know that. That's why I looked around and said, oh, we're all the regulars here. You know, it's usually depicted as a circle, like the face of a clock. And at 1 o'clock is where it all begins, if a circle ever begins, with ignorance. You know, we just aren't paying attention to what's happening. We just aren't paying attention. So when ignorance arises, you know, then that causes, you know, karmic formations at the 2 o'clock, the 2 o'clock position, you know, and our easiest karmic formation maybe is it's our karma as humans to really separate the world out into many things. And there's me and there's you. There's my things and there's your things. And this accumulation of economic wealth is seen as one of the causes. Excuse me for my cold. One of the causes of the incessant kind of drilling for more and more energy and more and more wealth, and a central cause of our climate change and the increased carbon in the atmosphere. So around and round it goes, one thing causing something else. Our feelings towards something is on there, around 7 or 8 maybe, where we move towards the things we want, and when we move towards them, we crave them and we cling on tightly to them. And, you know, then the thing really appears, then it really starts going, and birth happens, the arising of what we want, or the making of what we want happens. And when birth arises, which is around 11, I think, when things arise, that causes sickness, old age, and death. Excuse me, I'll blow my nose, and that'll be it. That'll be the end of my by sniffling. So birth is the primary cause of sickness, old age, and death. And then we start all over again. And our samsara life, our samsaric life, just keeps going around this exquisitely linked 12-fold chain. And in one sutra, Ananda praises the concept of dependent co-arising as a wonderful, as really being central. The Buddha sort of gives him some faint praise for realizing how important it is, but he cautions Ananda that it still isn't so simple. You know, we've got these two ideas that, you know, the pool ball, the cue ball causes this to move. You know, this arises, so that arises. We've got this nice 12-fold chain, but still, it is a very complicated system. It's hardly ever just one cue ball that causes our life to happen. You know, we're part of the, you know, one cue ball is we need a certain temperature to be able to live. We need another cue ball is we're dependent on food and water and shelter and clothing, and we're dependent on all of our ancestors. We're dependent on the sun, the moon, and the stars. It takes the entire universe of cue balls for every bit of phenomena, for these glasses, for this body, for this clock. So that was Buddha's warning, that we've got these nice models, and the idea that all phenomena, including these bodies and minds, are the product of causes and conditions arising and ceasing over and over again. But it's a very complicated system. In many sutras, in the Pali Canon, the trick to reversing climate change, or reversing sickness, old age, and death, suffering, sickness, old age, and death can be lumped up into suffering. The liberation of suffering is most often just to go the other way around. If we really look at our suffering and say, you know, birth, the arising is the cause of sickness, old age, and death. If we don't think that something arises, if we really are confident that, you know, everything that appears really is just a momentary product of infinite causes and arises. So there's no place that I can say that is birth, because everything is just sort of coming together in this way for a time, so that we think that something just appears. But if we really sort of say that, you know, okay, there isn't any real birth, anything that really says right now is when that happened, then we don't move on to sickness, old age, and death. When we can really see that craving and grasping causes things to be real. You know, these glasses aren't real for me until I say, oh, I can't read, I need to put them on. I've got an attachment to these glasses. If we can take a look at our desire, our craving, and our clinging, then the world isn't so solid. That's the traditional way of looking. We go all the way backwards. We break the chain. Actually, you can just break the chain in any place. But if you just break the chain at any one of the links, that's liberation from suffering. So here we are with our climate change. We're a hotter world now. It's getting hotter. And to work backward, you know, we do things like, you know, I've really got to take a look at plastic in my life. Everybody has to look at plastic in their lives. But so that's the climate change equivalent of going backwards around this 12-fold chain. You know, maybe I'll be a vegetarian. That'll reduce energy extraction. I'll insulate my house a little bit better. You know, we just that's the equivalent of going in that direction. And we're all doing that. And I hope we can think of marvelous ways to do all of that on a big scale. I was just thinking how difficult it was getting to the San Jose airport to go to this conference. You know, I could ask friends, it's not so easy. We don't have such a great transportation system in this, an efficient transportation in this country. So we don't have to just all get on our bicycles is the only way to do it. That will certainly help. But there's large scale projects that we could all buy into that are the equivalent of going the other way around on that 12-fold chain. Lots of great possibilities. You know, in this last week when I've been preparing for this talk, I thought I'd, you know, try to go to the source, the Pali Canon, and see what things were said about Praticca Samutpada. Where I usually go is that website, Access to Insight, which has the whole Pali Canon on it. And you can just, you get in the website, you just type the words, and up come all these sutras where you can find it talked about. And up comes a whole bunch of commentaries that Theravadan teachers have written over the years, largely from Bhikkhu Bodhi and Thanissaro Bhikkhu. That search turned me on to this article by Bhikkhu Bodhi on a few other ways of looking at dependent co-arising. He said that in a few sutras, a few small sutras, scattered throughout the huge volume of the Pali Canon, there's another formulation of 23 chain links, starting at ignorance and ending at liberation, going in one continuous circle. That was very interesting to Bhikkhu Bodhi and then myself. When you really abide in your suffering, Bhikkhu Bodhi explains about this sutra, one of which is the Upanisa Sutta in the section called the Samyutta Nikaya, the division of sutras. When you really abide in suffering, saying, you know, all of this stuff in my life has caused suffering. It's true. I really know what the cause of my suffering is. When you really understand that, you've got confidence that dependent co-arising has ended up with suffering. And that confidence or faith leads to the next link, which is joy. I can really look at this. Maybe I can be liberated. Maybe my suffering will be a little bit less. And the way Buddhists think, joy leads to greater joy, rapture. You're just really excited about it. And then you sort of say, okay, I'm just so happy that I have a plan now. I'm going to go in this direction. Maybe I should calm down a little bit. Maybe I should be a little tranquil and see what to do. So then tranquility, the cause of tranquility is rapture. You know, first you have to have the rapture, and then that causes the tranquility. And then tranquility leads to many other things that I've written down. Once you've got tranquility, you have happiness. Then you can start concentrating on what to do next, because that leads to the knowledge and vision of things as they are. My gosh, that's starting to sound like Mahayana Buddhism. Those are Bhikkhu Bodhi's terms. But that was Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of this sutra, of knowledge of things as they are. And then, you know, then when you see things as they are, you start, you know, really becoming, dropping your attachments, which are called kind of drearily disenchantment and dispassion. I don't like those terms so much, but they basically mean, you know, then you can really let go. And that leads to emancipation and the destruction of the hindrances to liberation. So it was this great thing not that I'm not washing every plastic bag, not that I'm not dutifully going backwards on that 12-fold chain, but it's a little different spirit to to get liberation through washing plastic bags than going through rapture and with real rapture washing those plastic bags. So it's a great thing to think about, and it's sort of it came right out of early Buddhism, this kind of real joy of practice and liberation. Bhikkhu Bodhi says about this, as a living experience, the advance to emancipation, kind of going around that big circle that takes on joy and happiness and rapture and tranquility and emancipation. So as a living experience, the advance to emancipation cannot be tied down to a series of mere negations. That's what the mere negations is what he's calling the traditional way of okay, I'll give up plastic bags. Okay, I'll change my diet. For such a mode of treatment, going backwards omits precisely what is most essential to the spiritual quest, that immediacy of inner striving, growth, and transformation. Parallel to the demolition of old barriers, there occurs, in the quest for deliverance, a widening of vistas characterized by an evolving sense of maturation. Isn't that our experience when we sit here and follow our breath and abide in connectivity to each other and to a larger, doesn't our world get bigger seem bigger in this practice? Doesn't our body expand as it stops being just this form that needs a certain amount of things to survive, to being the whole, our body then becomes the whole universe. So that's what Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying here. Parallel to the demolition of old barriers, there occurs in the quest for deliverance a widening of vistas characterized by an evolving sense of maturation, enrichment, and fulfillment. The departure from bondage, anxiety, and suffering at the same time means the move towards freedom and peace. So I thought that was just another great way of looking at this idea of dependent co-arising. These two ways of going, they don't really cancel each other out. It's just acknowledging that, I think even in the traditional way of looking at liberation of suffering through going backwards around the chain, I think that starts with this kind of joy and ease of, I can do this. I can really do this. I can make the changes that need to be made in my life to minimize suffering for myself and others. I can really make changes to reduce my carbon footprint. And I think I've been on diets before that I didn't want to go on. But I feel a little bit more joyful, or a little let's take a look at how we can all reduce the carbon footprint of of humanity. So I think they don't negate each other. It's just a different way, and it's nice that the Buddha saw that real joy of bodhicitta, of the opening of the eyes, and saying, you know, I'm not just going to go around to ignorance anymore. My eyes are open, and I'm feeling pretty good about this. I'm going to keep going, and it's not going to be such a big deal to reuse those plastic bags, to write letters about making sure we can still have the bullet train to Los Angeles. I can write a few of those letters. I want to end in just a few minutes. I mean, we'll end in just a few minutes with... I guess another thing I wanted to say was a memory of in 1989, Santa Cruz was a big rubble pit after the earthquake. It was a mess. There was real devastation here. Lives were lost. Homes were lost in this small area, in lots of areas in Northern California. I was out of town the day of the earthquake, but I was here the next day, and so I was able to participate in the bodhisattvas that emerged. And when I started thinking about it, I went a little Mahayana crazy. You know, that really was the earth trembling and all the bodhisattvas coming out of the earth, just like in the Lotus Sutra. But everybody we ran into were bodhisattvas helping each other out. And that is the spirit that we look at, abiding in climate change or facing climate change, is that spirit of all the bodhisattvas working together. A famous line, you know, Bill McKibben has been a climate activist for more than 30 years, and a great writer and a great thinker. Everyone's probably heard this line, but somebody came up to him after one of his talks, all inspired and, you know, maybe in the joy rapture stage of being freed from bondage, and said, you know, I loved that, Bill. You know, tell me, how can an individual, you know, work on turning around climate? What can we do as individuals to what's the best thing to do? You know, is it plastic bags? Is it riding by? I mean, that's what was it. You know, what can an individual do? And Bill McKibben said, stop being an individual. Meaning, you know, it's time for all of us to join all the bodhisattvas. And because it's too big. I think that was Greta Thunberg. We all heard her speech at the United Nations. She was so angry. You know, we've known you, not we. You've known about this for more than 30 years. When you could have done something, when it would have been easy. Now our house is on fire. We're in a mess. It could be too late. I mean, that's where the real rage came from. But it's not just about plastic bags and bicycling. It's really this the bonding, the doing it all together in the same way that we were all together in the 89 earthquake and put Santa Cruz and many other local communities back together. That real connectedness.